Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, March 23rd, 2016. There's something really rotten in Arizona. Yesterday was primary day in the great state of Arizona. And particularly in the city of Phoenix, it was all gummed up from beginning to end. People who showed up at their polling place found that their names weren't on the list. Democrats who had voted with the party for decades and never re-registered found themselves listed as independents. And independents aren't allowed to vote in the Arizona primary. It's not an open primary. So, structurally, a third of the people were cut out of the election, and then that third was enhanced by people who, without any action of their own, found that their names had been reclassified as independent voters. And when they squawked, when they finally got to the front of these incredible lines at polling places, they were given provisional ballots. And we know, those of us who have followed election integrity issues, that provisional ballots are rarely counted. And usually, by the time, the some that are counted are tabulated, well, people have moved on and nobody cares anymore. And so what I saw was really discouraging. And I want to ding the networks. Let me start there. Because they did something that was truly reprehensible. Let me offer this example. Here in California, because we're 3 hours behind New York, on presidential election days, the networks voluntarily withhold results from the East Coast until the polls have closed on the West Coast, so as not to discourage people by proclaiming the outcome before we get to vote out here. And likewise, in Arizona last night, the networks irresponsibly used the absentee ballots, the mail-in ballots, to project a winner while thousands and thousands of people were still lined up waiting for their opportunity to vote. And it also calls into question the way the networks declared this election on the Democratic side for Clinton, on the Republican side for Trump. Because they went forward with their projections, even though irregularities were clearly evident, and the corporate media is not interested in the issues I just described of voters who were deprived of the right to vote because of some shenanigans in the election rolls. No, that's too messy. So, yes, the networks did show that the lines were long, and they sent young reporters I'd never seen before who zipped up and down the line to demonstrate how many people were waiting to vote, particularly in Phoenix and at some of the caucuses in Utah. Most of this was chalked up to higher turnout, and the networks irresponsibly suggested that because of the terrorist attacks in Brussels yesterday, that many people were turning out to vote, and they implied that the right vote to respond to the terrorists was a vote for Donald Trump. And so, what I saw is a seriously bungled election process in Phoenix. Huge turnout that should have favored Bernie Sanders, although when you cut the independents out of the Arizona vote, it is understandable that he might not beat Clinton. But the numbers that were showing were 2-1 in favor of Hillary. And as I watched the tally go forward over the evening, it got stuck at 71%, and by the time I went to bed at midnight Pacific time, it was still showing 71%. So there are serious irregularities, and nevertheless, the corporate media just breezes right past all that. The New York Times headline, "Clinton and Trump Win Arizona," describing Hillary's victory as commanding. Now, they hadn't even counted all the votes. And yet, they reached those conclusions. At The Guardian, the headline, "Clinton and Trump Win Big in Arizona." and barely a mention of the long lines or any complications caused by the election officials. Same way for Vice News. They just played it corporate down the middle. Hey, here's the winner. There were long lines. And let's move on. And so this is really troubling, because we haven't learned a damn thing from the stolen elections of 2000, the stolen election of 2004, and many unusual anomalies that have occurred at various election levels along the way. So the Times merely reported that turnout in Arizona, Utah, and Idaho was unusually high, with long lines, some snaking for several blocks at polling places and caucus sites. The ballot counting in Arizona was delayed as officials extended voting to account for people who were waiting in line for hours in some cases. Yes, 5.5 hours. People who went to the polling place before 7 p.m. Some of them waited until after midnight to vote. And in Mesa, Arizona, I've seen a video where an election employee was cutting off people who were trying to get in line because it was after 7 p.m. He said, "The polls are closed and we are cutting off your access to vote." Now, these people weren't late. They were delayed because the election officials, either intentionally or just because they're stupid, reduced the number of polling places. And that was most sharply the case in Phoenix, in Maricopa County. And the election county recorder, the election official is called, her name is Helen Purcell. She took responsibility for the long lines at the polls. Quote, "We certainly made bad decisions, and having only 60 polling places, didn't anticipate there would be that many people going to the polling places." Now, her theory was that most of the people were going to vote by mail. Let's put aside the fraud potential of mail-in ballots and just say, okay, it's convenient and a lot of people vote that way, and it has been moving in that direction. But she set up, instead of 200 locations, as they had in 2012, only 60 locations. Many of the polling places that were not open yesterday were in minority communities, including the extensive Latino population in Arizona. And so each polling place in Maricopa County had to handle as many as 21,000 voters. And that's based on 60 locations divided into 1.25 million eligible voters. And we'll find out somewhere down the road what the actual turnout was, but it was high. It was very high. And so, from beginning to end, this election was riddled with problems. And these are driven by the voter suppression tactics that have been orchestrated by Republicans all across the country. And remember, Jan Brewer, who became the accidental governor of Arizona because Barack Obama appointed the former governor, Janet Napolitano, to run Homeland Security. Jan Brewer is a total nut. She was Secretary of State, the election official, before she became governor. And so they have gamed the system to prevent Democrats from voting. And when I watched that on TV last night, it was just the vivid evidence that these tactics are working. And I want you to know that, just so you didn't have to, I spent 1 hour watching CNN, maybe a little more, another hour watching Fox, and then I watched MSNBC. And while I was watching Fox, the guy I like to call the little mother, Tucker Carlson, was there in his bow tie. And I jotted down what he said, because he was looking at these long lines, and he was giving us a civics lecture, about the importance of credible elections. And if they're not credible, if people think they're rigged, then they won't participate, and it is a recipe for revolution. He said these long lines are embarrassing and a threat. And I'm thinking, wow, Tucker, election protection, election integrity. I never thought you even, contemplated the terms. And so then he went on to say, In some countries, they don't have voting integrity. It causes instability. They think an election has been stolen. And in some cases, they're right. And then he floored me when he said, we've never experienced that in the United States in the last 100 years. Oh, Tucker, where have you been? Where have you been? And so as I watched the tally, I jotted down because I started to get suspicious. And when they threw the election to Hillary on the projections, with 71% of the vote counted and all those people who hadn't voted, I noticed that they showed a 60% vote tally for Hillary and a 37% margin for Sanders. About 20 minutes later, 60.5, 37.0. And about another 15 minutes later, 60.6 to 36.8. Now, all of these were based on only 71% of the ballots. And those were mail-in ballots that had been counted probably during the day or maybe even before Election Day. But nobody piped up with any questions. Nobody challenged the integrity of this process. And I hope the Sanders campaign will fight this one. They threw in the towel in Missouri where they had an opportunity for a free recount. I know it was only a 2 percentage point difference and the, you know, number of delegates allocated wouldn't have changed. But I believe Massachusetts was taken from Sanders. The exit polling was 7 points different from the actual victory for Clinton recorded in the election results. And too many Americans just accept this as at face value. Our election process is in shambles. It's not uniform. And I've got a note via Mark Crispin Miller at NYU from an individual who participated in the Republican caucus in Utah. And this person, I'll guess it's a guy, I don't really know, but he reports that he showed up at the caucus and he was handed 50 ballots. Nobody checked his credentials. They didn't look if his name was on a list. It's just, hey, come on down. And the ballots were not controlled in any way. So in the first room he went to, he had 50 ballots, but he was a good enough person to only fill out one and give the rest back. But he saw other people who were filling out multiple ballots and stuffing them into containers. Then he goes into another room 15 minutes later. Somebody walks in with an envelope stuffed full of absentee ballots, some having 2 to 5 or more ballots. I said, gosh, isn't there an absentee process already in place? Didn't people have to register for that by last week? And somebody said, oh no, it's completely normal. And then as he was getting ready to leave that room, somebody handed him another ballot. So at his precinct, the posted numbers were 74% for Cruz, 14% Trump, 11% for Kasich. And if this is any indication of the process across all of Utah, then this was just a free-for-all that was controlled by the allies of Mr. Cruz, which includes the Tea Party senator from Utah, Mike Lee. That's my speculation. I have no proof of any of this, but that would be the suggestion that I would offer. So the other thing that was so bizarre to watch was because of the attacks that occurred in Brussels, and there were still, you know, updates coming from that, all of the networks interwove gruesome footage from the airport and the subway station in Brussels with the election coverage. And the election coverage is done, as I describe it, in this kind of sports center, you know, scoreboard way. And so you then interject the fear element that comes from the coverage of the terrorist attacks. And in many cases, I felt the clear inferences that this is why you should vote for Trump. They also suggested that the huge turnout was driven by people who were so affected by the news from Brussels that they had to run out and vote for Trump. And this becomes a real problem. And Trump, of course, is trotting out his close the borders, his, you know, we need to add more surveillance in Muslim communities. There's already a lot, Donald. Ask the FBI. And Ted Cruz is saying the same thing. He wants patrols in Muslim communities, as if that's going to do anything or identify people who are ready to put on a suicide bomb vest. And so it really has spun out of control. And I want to share with you a moment that stunned me. I've watched a woman named S.E. Cupp, C-U-P-P. I first saw her on Bill Maher's show. She was hired by CNN as a conservative commentator. And I'll say this, she is no Ann Coulter. And still, you know, most of the stuff she said never really impressed me. But last night, in less than 30 seconds, she responded to a prompt from Anderson Cooper and said, yes, it's bizarre what Donald Trump is saying about the need to waterboard and torture captured suspects in relation to the Paris and Brussels bombings. She said, yeah, it's bizarre that under the umbrella of standing athwart political correctness, that Trump makes the conversation about doing away with the Geneva Conventions, which the U.S. can't unilaterally do, and making the argument that somehow that we're weaker when we follow rules like the Geneva Conventions. She said, actually, we're better than them. And I was really surprised to hear that come from her. And unfortunately, there was no discussion that was prompted by this important statement she made. Anderson Cooper did a promo for what they were going to do next and went to a commercial break. Now, Trump also is all over the place, as usual, because in addition to his call for, you know, Muslim patrols and closing the borders and more surveillance, he has backed away from some of his biggest blustery comments about the Islamic State. And as of yesterday, he said he wants to cut America's contributions to NATO. Now, NATO is headquartered in Brussels. It was likely one of the reasons why they selected that city, because NATO forces are part of the bogus coalition fighting the Islamic State. And so it's just amazing to hear him move all over the place. He also dialed back his position on inserting American troops to fight the Islamic State. And yet the media just fawns all over this guy and doesn't call him out. I mean, from time to time, they'll note that he is a prevaricator, that he's not telling the truth, but it doesn't stick, and they don't stick with it. I want to recommend two pieces that have been published in the last day or two at consortiumnews.com. Robert Perry, who is the editor there and the founder of Consortium News, he published a piece called The Clinton-Trump AIPAC Panderoff. And it's a brilliant piece. I don't have time to quote a lot of it to you today, but I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast. And he basically quotes the pandering comments from Hillary Clinton and the pandering comments from Donald Trump, who opened by saying, I didn't come here tonight to pander to you about Israel. And then he took on the challenge, says Perry, of out-pandering Clinton. And he appeared to succeed. And then Perry also covers what he considers to be the, more balanced commentary of Bernie Sanders and the way he has expanded his positions on foreign policy in the speech that he gave the other day. And Perry also notes that it may be too late, that Sanders may have waited too long to articulate these important points and in contrast with Hillary Clinton's hawkishness. Also at Consortium News, Joe Lauria, who gave us an interview from Iraq last week that we published here at peterbcollins.com, he takes a slightly more critical view of Bernie Sanders, headlining Sanders tiptoes in criticizing Israel, and I think Joe makes some valid points. So I invite you to read both commentaries and draw your own conclusions and develop your own opinions. And Bibi Netanyahu also spoke at AIPAC via a videotape. And I'll just note that he was dialing back the bluster and even found a moment to thank President Obama for his support, including for ballistic missile defense. Yeah, the Iron Dome. It's a lie. Oh, speaking of lies, Jason Leopold has finally gotten a hold of the largely unredacted 93-page national intelligence estimate from the fall of 2002. And this is the intelligence document that was used selectively. They cherry-picked different kinds of lines, the way people, you know, manipulate language in a movie ad where they quote a critic who didn't say it was a great movie, but they pick out just three or four words that suggest that that critic did like it. Well, that's what they did. And just to help you out a little bit, I want to take you back to the fall of 2002 and let you hear the lies and the liars who spoke them.
Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
A clear threat to the United States.
And there's dozens of ballistic missiles.
It is sponsored and sheltered terrorists.
Paying suicide
Chemical
bombers.
Chemical weapons are equally chosen.
Biological weapons, including anthrax and botulism toxins.
Biological and chemical agent to kill millions of people.
Chemical weapons, including VX and sarin, mustard gas.
To a massive and sudden horror.
Massive death and destruction.
Death on a massive scale.
So those were the talking points of the Bush administration. They all claimed they were based on intelligence information, and they did cherry-pick from the intelligence estimate. And I've linked to Jason's powerful piece. You can read it for yourself. But what he shows is that this was used and manipulated to prepare a case for war that did not exist. And on every item, the lies that you just heard, whether it was anthrax, the potential for nuclear weapons, biological weapons, the intelligence estimate didn't support the conclusions that were drawn by top Bush administration officials. For example, the National Intelligence Estimate read that Iraq probably has renovated a vaccine production plant to manufacture biological weapons, but we are unable to determine whether the research has resumed. They also said, flatly, that Saddam did not have sufficient material to manufacture any nuclear weapons, and the information we have does not appear consistent with a coherent effort to reconstitute a nuclear weapons program. That didn't stop Condoleezza Rice from talking about mushroom clouds. And it goes on into more detail about the aluminum tubes that were desired for missiles and not for nuclear bomb construction, about the false notion that al-Qaeda was in collaboration with the government of Iraq and its dictator, Saddam Hussein. And in particular, this is really fascinating to me, because we know that a man named al-Libi was captured and was tortured, and he coughed up information about mobile weapons labs and the reconstituted biological weapons program in Iraq. But one of the redactions that remains in the document that Jason Leopold got a hold of is the actual date in February 2003 when al-Libi recanted his claims. So it reads here, Ibn Sheikh al-Libi recanted the claims after he was rendered to CIA custody on February blank 2003. Now, we invaded in the middle of March. And in some ways, the date in February isn't that significant, but if it was earlier in the month, it means that they knew they were about to invade based on flat-out lies, or at least unproven allegations that had been delivered under torture. So this is a remarkable finding, and we need to wake up and recognize that we are in the same climate right now, where the response to these events and to the rise of the Islamic State is more perpetual war. And we've got to say no to it. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. I want to thank Gene Hetzel, who just took out a new annual subscription in the last 24 hours. Welcome aboard, Gene. And in the same time period, Lauren Howard renewed her annual subscription, and so did Gordon Lewis. So I want to thank each of you for your strong support of the Peter B. Collins Podcast, and I'll be getting in touch with you, Gene, to see which bonus book title you want to select Joe Hickman's The Burn Pits. We've got John Perkins' New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And I still have a few copies left of the Field Guide to the F Word. Supreme Court heard oral arguments today, and I haven't been able to get full details, but this is on the contraceptive case from the Obamacare Affordable Care Act. And this is a bogus issue presented by right-wing Catholics in this country, and they've cynically used the Little Sisters of the Poor as the plaintiffs in this case. It's a follow-up to the Hobby Lobby case, where they're trying to expand claims of religious freedom in order to deny the rights of other people. And so, these nuns are saying that their employees, or people who attend institutions where they operate a hospital or a school, are not entitled to get contraceptive coverage under their insurance plans because it would violate the moral beliefs of these nuns. And it's really preposterous. It is this expansion of religious rights into a territory that violates the rights of others. And that is fundamentally unfair. We'll have to see how the 8-member Supreme Court rules on this one, because Antonin Scalia isn't there to cast what could be a pivotal vote. President Obama considers what I'm dubbing his reconciliation tour. He started in Cuba, and he arrived for a 2-day state visit in Argentina today. And it's a real complicated picture, partly because it coincides with the 40th anniversary of the U.S.-backed military coup that left an estimated 30,000 people missing. And the School of the Americas was central in, you know, basically training the military in that country to suppress the rights of the people and to create desaparecidos, the disappeared. And so the president, on the one hand, has ordered the release of documents, that have been classified for years related to the CIA's role in that coup. But he also is arriving at a time when a pro-American, pro-business conservative president has just taken office, and his name is Mauricio Macri. And so the complicated history of America's relationship with Argentina is still very complicated, and one of the angles is that for years the poor have received subsidies for their utility bills in Argentina, and this new pro-business president is apparently ready to cut them back. He also has come to terms with most of the vultures, including American Paul Singer, who hold the debt of Argentina. And let me clarify that. He's come to terms with most of the vultures, but not Paul Singer, who has sued Argentina in American courts. Well, we continue to attack in Yemen. If you thought that we've turned that little conflict over to Saudi Arabia, that's not the case. We did another bombing raid overnight, and dozens of people were killed at what we described as an al-Qaeda training camp in southern Yemen. And this was an airstrike conducted apparently by fighter jets with the help of drones providing reconnaissance. And speaking of drones, on Sunday, the New York Times ran a good editorial. It noted that Lisa Monaco, the White House Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor, announced a couple of weeks ago that she will be releasing detailed information about the drone strikes. And in particular, we may be able to find out how many civilians the administration believes it has killed in drone strikes aimed at so-called militants and terrorists. But the Times notes that even what is promised will be too little, too late. And I agree with this. The Times reads, one of the goals of the administration is to show that it has killed fewer civilians in drone strikes since the White House instituted more stringent rules of engagement. But we've got a lot of problems with the drone wars. And if you imagine a President Trump in office a year from now who uses the power that Obama has exercised fighting drone wars in countries where we don't have any agreements, where we have no obligation, like Yemen, like Somalia. Chloe's very upset by this. She doesn't like drones. At any rate, when Obama killed the American Anwar al-Awlaki with a drone strike in Yemen, He set a precedent that a President Trump could take to a whole new level. And I, for one, am very concerned about that. Now, speaking of drones, there's a powerful new movie out that has gotten great reviews that I've read, starring Helen Mirren, and it's about drones, about the use of drones in contemporary conflicts, and it's called Eye in the Sky. And our official movie reviewer, Gary Chu from Sacramento, California, checks in today with his review of Eye in the Sky.
We've seen a million or more police procedurals in movies and on TV. They began well before television's Joe Friday was around keeping Los Angeles safe. Time enough has slipped by for us to now learn the intricate steps of the drone procedural. That's what Gavin Hood's new film, Eye in the Sky, brilliantly allows. Al-Shabaab is the bad guy. Helen Mirren as Colonel Catherine Powell is the principal good gal, tasked with capturing a British citizen who's gone over to Al-Shabaab's side. But going along, the story complicates itself into an absolute edge-of-your-seat smart thriller that becomes a mission not to arrest, but kill, with collateral damage being the elephant in the room. What about the young Kenyan girl unknowingly just outside the targeted Al-Shabaab safe house where the bad bomber guys are suiting up in their suicide vests? The child is merely bringing in a modicum of money for her family on a sunny afternoon. Along the dusty thoroughfare, she's selling her mother's freshly baked bread. Colonel Powell and her cadre of high-tech people on the ground in Nairobi, Nevada, and the UK are all connected by the awesome technology of satellite audio-video communications. The team is terribly surreptitious about how it sets about to accomplish the mission. They have drones, ones that fly high above, all locked and loaded, and tiny drones that just snoop. If you saw one land on your arm in the warmth of summer, you'd smack it with the palm of your hand. Talk about bugs. Then there are those pesky minuscule drones you'd swear are just sparrows flitting about over the target, but actually gathering in-the-moment intelligence for eyes and ears scattered around the world. Talk about privacy. Eye in the Sky presents to you with the same precision as modern drone warfare does. Keep your eye peeled for the occasional graphics that appear at the lower left of the screen so you'll know in what hemisphere the next scene is about to take place. The military's chain of command, as well as the pecking order of major governments, are a large part of Hood's film, too. One of those characters is Colonel Powell's immediate superior, Lieutenant General Frank Benson, played by the recently passed and truly fine actor Alan Rickman. As it usually happens with Rickman, scenes get stolen by him. Eye in the Sky is dedicated to his memory. Well down the chain of command, a long distance from the target, there's Steve Watts, Aaron Paul, Walter White's obstreperous assistant meth chef on Cable's Breaking Bad, is the all-important trigger guy in the Nevada desert. Watts, with his new assistant played by Phoebe Fox, makes Hellfire missiles fly. Everyone in the scattered chain to execute an important mission in Kenya can plainly see the little girl selling her family's baked goods. And so can you. Morality is, if you'll excuse the expression, the trump card for all that's afoot in this excellent film. How many will be killed later by a squad of zealous suicide bombers over against the collateral damage that would ensue if the order comes down before Al-Shabaab strikes to fire ordnance from the drone that's circling the Nairobi sky? It pleased me that Rickman has the best line in the movie. Never tell a soldier he doesn't know the cost of war. This powerful statement fits well with Guy Hibbert's screenplay, as Eye in the Sky lauds military personnel and powerful politicians alike for the hard decisions they often make. But I just couldn't help also thinking about people involved in tough real-life decisions like this who can't or won't feel the tug of humanity on their souls if the command does come down to pull that trigger. For the Peter B. Collins Podcast, I'm Gary Chu in Sacramento.
Thanks, Gary, for your review of Eye in the Sky. And I don't know if Alan Parsons' music makes an appearance in the soundtrack of this film, but it'd be a good fit. Here's one of their tunes, and it's called, you guessed it, Eye in the Sky.
I am the eye in the sky.